So yesterday we started this thermodynamics in expanding universe. And of course, the goal is to describe some very nice processes which happened in the history of our universe. And hopefully, if I have time, I'll mention them towards the end of this lecture. But for example, how the CMB was released, or how helium was fused in the very early minutes after the Big Bang, and stuff like that. And for that, we need some machinery, and it's the machinery of this thermodynamics in expanding universe. And I told you that in principle, you would have to find the distribution function, and that's given by the Boltzmann equation. But it's quite a complicated approach, and you have to typically do it numerically, unless you have some very, very trivial ansatz for the right-hand side of the Boltzmann equation. And so instead, we'll be doing something much, much simpler. And it's basically, you will be saying that we are in local thermal equilibrium, in which case we just take the distribution function to be that of Bose Einstein or Fermi Dirac distribution. And so it's given here, minus is for bosons, plus is for fermions, where we take the relativistic dispersion relation for the energies here. And so this distribution function, you can trust it as long as this condition is satisfied. So actually, you establish the equilibrium as long as the collision time for the reactions which are happening are much, much smaller than the time it takes to significantly expand the universe. And so the reaction rate 1 over the reaction rate for a given reaction is much, much smaller than 1 over the Hubble constant, which basically tells you, you know, how quickly the universe is expanding. Or if you just revert these things, that the reaction rate must be much, much bigger than the rate of H. Okay? So that's the condition under which we are using this standard distribution function. In more general cases, if this is not true, you have to use the Boltzmann equation or other kinetic equation. So anyway, so once we have the distribution function, whether it's given by this or by anything else, you calculate the density of the particles, the energy density, and the pressure according to these formulas. So we integrate the distribution function over the momentum. And so we get n as a function of x and t. And similarly, you would have rho, but now you have EF. And then you have that strange formula, p squared over 3EF for the pressure. So now you can use the fact that we are using this dispersion relation. So everything depends only on the magnitude of p. And so that's why you can turn the integral into integration over spherical coordinates in this momentum space and turn everything into the integration over the energies. And so this is the resulting formula. So now we looked at that formula yesterday in the relativistic limit, where basically the temperature is the only thing which has units of energy, and it's much, much bigger than any other things which have units of energy, like the mass or the chemical potential mu. And then basically, based on dimensional argument, you can show that the density of the particles, which is just number of particles divided by volume. So you have 1 over L cubed, which has to go like energy cube. And the only energy you have at your disposal is the temperature. So it has to go like T cubed. And similarly, or the energy density has to go like T to the 4. And pressure has the same unit, so T to the 4. So now you can calculate these precise numbers by simply doing this integral. And I did it for the density. But in your homework, you have to do it for energy density and for the pressure as well. But I'm already giving you some results. So if you actually do it properly, then p over rho is just 1/3. So knowing one, you know the other. So if you treat, you know, you are supposed to verify, I think, this thing here. So really, you cannot save any time, and you have to calculate both things here. Okay, so that was the relativistic limit. So now let me briefly discuss what happens in the non-relativistic case. So non-relativistic. And so what I mean by that is that actually now the temperatures are much smaller than the mass. And I will also consider that the chemical potential is smaller than the mass. In which case, the temperature is small, than E, so this is huge. So I can neglect this minus plus one. And so, for example, for the particle density, so the particle density is 1 over 2 pi square. And it's an integral from m to infinity. And then e square minus m square e dE. But now I'm neglecting that plus minus 1. So it's e to e minus mu over t. So now you might think it would be reasonable to introduce a new variable x, which would be e minus mu divided by t. But that's not the way to go for some reason. Rather, you call a new variable e minus m divided by t. One of the reasons why you choose that new variable is that this lower limit actually now becomes 0. Okay? So now I'm choosing a new variable. Let's call it u is e minus m over t. In other words, e is just ut plus m. Okay, and so this is what you want to do. And so now I write it as minus m and plus m here. And so I'll have u. And then I'll have m minus mu over t. But that doesn't depend on u, so I can take it out of the integral. Okay, so this is given by 1 over 2 pi square. And then from the denominator, I can take this part m minus mu over t. So it's e mu minus m over t comes from the bottom. And then I have the range from 0 now to infinity. That's why the u is a useful thing to do. And then you have e square minus m square. Okay, so e square is u square t square plus m square plus 2 utm minus m square, coming from this minus. And then you have e, which is ut plus m, and then dE is t du, and then divided by e to u. Okay, so now there is this exponential suppression in u. So there's this e to minus u standing in the integral. And so for some reason, you can argue that this gives you the right result if you treat u as a small quantity here. So I'll always only keep the terms to the smallest order in u in the denominator, because there's this e to u in the bottom. Okay, so this term is gone. M square is gone. So I just survive these and that term over there. And then the lowest expansion in u is just keeping m here. So I'm just keeping terms to lowest order in u I can. And so if you do this, then we have, okay, so this is 1 over 2 pi square. And then you have t here, and then t to 1 half, which gives you t to 3 halves. And similarly for m, that's m t to 3 halves coming out of this. And we still have that exponential here, e mu minus m divided by t. And then this is simply an integral from 0 to infinity. Now the only thing which survives here is tu to u, and du and then e power u. Okay, yes?
Can you repeat again why only the terms in lower?
I'm just telling you. I didn't really justify why this is the right thing to do. Well, okay. So what you are basically, so in this limit, you are saying t is small.
Yep.
But I want non-relativistic case. So it's obvious that e actually cannot be much larger than m as well. But now I'm actually saying, yeah, e minus m is actually even smaller than t, right? So I sort of like decoupled from the thermal thing. And yeah, so this is, yeah. So this guy is even smaller than that guy to get the right non-relativistic limit. But I haven't really justified why it is so. Apart from the fact that it gives the right answer. Okay, so this thing here is just an integral, just some number which you can do, and happens to be pi over 2 square root of that. That's square root of pi over 2, which is not that important. But what you are, so what is this? Is given by m. T divided by 2 pi to 3 halves, and then e to mu minus m over t. And so if you are not interested in the behavior of the chemical potential, then it's just e to minus, this is proportional to e to minus m over t. So let's say, okay. So this is the result which we get in the non-relativistic limit. And it tells you something about the childhood of thermodynamics. So it tells you that actually something had to happen to thermodynamics in its childhood. And since then, actually, the thermodynamics hates massive particles. Okay. So there's this, if the particle has a mass, m, then actually the abundance of that particle is exponentially suppressed by this e to minus m over t. Okay, so thermodynamics hates massive particles. And so whenever actually the particle is massive and it is in thermal equilibrium with other things, then its abundance is actually exponentially suppressed. Okay. Exponentially suppressed. So I did the calculation for n. And again, you will do it properly in your homework. But if you do for rho, then it's just given m mass of the particle times n, would find, and there's some number. And then if you do for the pressure, then you find that it's temperature times n. So if I form the ratio w again, which is p over rho, then it goes like T over M. And if you look at which limit we are taking the limit T is much, much smaller than M. So this is actually zero. So in other words, non-relativistic particles will have the equation of state where the pressure is basically zero, W is zero. Okay? This is what I told you will be taking for the matter, but now you actually shown it using the thermodynamic arguments. Questions? Very good. So now you know these things. Typically in the universe, what people are most interested in is what's happening to the entropy. And you can to the first approximation, which is very, very good approximation, you can treat the expansion of the universe as adiabatic, that the entropy, the total entropy and the universe is actually not changing. Okay, so universe expands adiabatically meaning that the total entropy, which you can write down as the entropy density times the volume, actually is constant. So this is the statement you will find in every textbook. The reason for this is that where do you think the entropy in the universe is actually hiding? So what is the major contribution to the entropy in the universe? What do you think? Any?
Black holes.
Did you say?
Black holes.
That's a very correct answer, actually. Yeah, so actually the biggest, if you calculate, you know, how much entropy is stored in the black holes, actually that will be true, that it's the biggest contribution to entropy whatsoever. But black holes typically do not interact and are not important for what we are going to discuss here. So you can sort of decouple them. So what else? So we have, you know, matter, we have lambda, we have radiation, whatever. So what do you think, which one is the most interesting?
Radiation.
So there's so many photons in the universe that actually the entropy of the CMB is huge. So you can actually show that, you know, no matter what's happening with the universe, you have some reactions, you are recombining electrons with protons, forming a hydrogen or whatever. There is some entropy production during this process, but that entropy production so can show that whatever process we have, the entropy production in that process is actually much, much smaller. Delta S is much, much smaller than the entropy already, which is there, which is basically the entropy of radiation plus, that was a correct thing, entropy of black holes, but these sort of decouple. So they are not interesting. But certainly it's the radiation which carries the most entropy. And the reason for that is that for every baryon or for every thing, you have 10 to the 9 photons in the universe. So there's 10 to the 9 times more photons than baryons. Okay, so for this reason, whatever the entropy production is in the process that you should consider, actually, so this will be non-trivial, but it will still be much, much smaller than this guy. And that's why you can treat expansion of the universe as adiabatic. Okay, so now what this means is that I have that S is S times V is constant, but you know that V goes like length cube, okay? So if you are interested in the entropy density, it goes like 1 over length cube. And as the universe expands, the length goes like the scale factor A. So from here, you conclude that the entropy density is proportional to 1 over A cube. Or, in other words, it has to go like T cube. Proportional to T cube. So now how to get this relation precisely? So how to get the number which is standing in front of this T cube? You will do all the dirty work in your homework. So let me consider, okay. So this will be true for the relativistic. Let me not write it yet. So this will be true only for relativistic particles. So S proportional to 1 over A cubed is always true. So I follow that. So now if you have relativistic particles, class of relativistic particles, and that will be true, what I wrote before. But again, we are treating the fact that the only thing which has the units of energy is the temperature. So we are neglecting masses, we are neglecting chemical potentials, and so on. So in which case, all the interesting quantities are just functions of temperatures we have seen, Pt, and so will be the entropy density as a function of T. In fact, it has to go as T cubed. And so to get the precise relation, how it behaves with T cubed, is that in your homework one, you show that if this is true, then dP over dT is given by rho plus P divided by T. Okay, so this is what you show in your homework. So now, if you remember the magic square for thermodynamics, again, it's here. So we have V, T, P, and S. Then you have the Maxwell relations, whatever is here at constant this guy is here at constant that guy. So in other words, dP over dT is dS over dV. Okay? So this is dS over dV. And it's always at constant the other thing. So it's dS over dV at constant P. But P, in this case, is a function of temperature only. So this is dS over dV at constant T at the same time. Okay? But the entropy is just given by the entropy density times the volume. And volume, of course, is independent from temperature. So the only temperature dependence is hiding at small s. So this is capital S. This is just the total density. Anyway, so what I'm saying is just you differentiate this relation S times V. And really, it's that simple that it gives just differentiating V. So it just gives S. Okay. So this is just S. So now we have this beautiful relation is that S, the entropy density is just rho plus P divided by T. And that's how you get what this entropy density really is. So in the previous, you know how this behaves with T precisely, how that behaves with T precisely, and now we know how precisely S behaves with T. And that depends on whether you are fermion or boson. So for bosons, if you plug in the numbers, it's just 2 pi square over 45, and then T cube. And for fermions, this is 7 over 8 of whatever is for boson. Does this make sense? So by the way, this relation can be also derived from the first law of thermodynamics. And you can look it up in the lecture notes. It's actually a three-line proof that this must be so. And it's like I write down the first law of thermodynamics, dE equals to TdS minus PdV. And then I treat everything as a function of T apart from V. I treat that you have quantities which depend on T, and you have quantities which depend on V. So you collect all the terms, you put everything dt times something on the left-hand side, and dv times something on the right-hand side. Because dv and dt are independent, whatever stands in front of them has to vanish separately. The left-hand side has to be equal to 0, right-hand side has to be equal to 0. Whatever stands in front of dt is precisely this. Okay, so it's rho plus p minus ts, whatever. So that would be like a physical proof of this relation. But because you do your homework, then this is much simpler to do it here. Very good. So we have now how the entropy density actually behaves for relativistic particles which are in equilibrium. So now, if you have really paths of relativistic particles, that can include lots of species of relativistic particles. So you typically have, well, photons are always relativistic, so they will have their own entropy contribution. But you can also have, for example, neutrinos, which are relativistic. So you have another species. Or if you are in very early universe, maybe the protons are also relativistic. If the energies are much, much bigger than the mass of the proton, that all these things will be relativistic. So class of relativistic species may include various relativistic species. And so, of course, the photons are always the most important. So that's why you measure everything in terms of their temperature. So let T is the temperature of photons. So now, if everything is actually, you know, interacting together, all these relativistic species will have the same temperature. But that's not always the case. It may happen that some species already sort of decoupled from the rest. There is no reaction coupling them to the other species. And so they can actually have different temperature. So the photons will have this temperature T, but it may happen that the other things have different temperature. And Ti will be temperature of other species, depending on what I is, I can have different temperatures here. Some of them will be certainly equal to T, but some of them may not be. And so then you can just write the entropy density to be given by this formula for bosons, let's say. So 2 pi square 45. 2 pi square 45. And then I write it in terms of the temperature of the photons. But this may not be correct because there are some other contributions from other species which actually have different temperature. And the way to do it is you just put some constant G star of S, which actually tunes for the fact that not everything is photon, and then you have other things as well. And then if you see this formula for G star of S is whatever you would expect. So you have sum over the bosons. And then you put Gi Ti over T to power cube. And then sum over fermions. And the fermions has this 7 over 8. So 7 over 8. Gi Ti over T cube. And so what I mean by these Gi's is basically how many degrees of freedom are there, how many different particles are in a given temperature. So for example, I don't know, if I had gravitons which were there, then you know that the gravitons, actually there are two kinds of gravitons, two degrees of freedom. So actually for gravitons, Gi would be 2. Okay, so photons, it's also 2 and whatever. So it's like how many species, how many different particles at that given temperature are there. So similarly, people write this for the density. Now, this number is just G star, not of S, but just G star. And then the formula for that is pi square over 30. T to the 4. Oh no, I'm giving you the result for the homework. Okay, and then this G star is exactly defined analogously, but now with T to the 4. So it's bosons, GI over T to the power 4, and then fermions, 7 over 8, GI, GI over T to the power 4. So now you see that if everything has the same temperature, all the TIs are actually equal to T, then the G star of S equals to G star. But if there are some different temperatures, then they are different. Okay. So these are the numbers which range from, I don't know, 100 particles could be relativistic in the past to 0 or 1 or whatever. Always have photons relativistic. But anyway, so and you can always estimate what this G star of S is, depending on at which time you consider your universe and how hot the universe is at that point. So you count contributions to all relativistic particles at a given temperature. So when the temperature is bigger than the rest mass or whatever than of the particle, then it's still relativistic and it contributes to this thing. Questions? Very good. So now we have that machinery. So now let me discuss this few thing, and that's the coupling and freeze out. And so basically the idea of this is that as long as you have equilibrium, it's boring. So it's really the departure from the equilibrium which is bringing something new to the universe. So it is the departure from equilibrium that makes life interesting. And I'll be very specific. I'll give you an example, interesting example, which actually something that could have happened, and that will be the freeze out of cold dark matter. But anyway, so the idea, before we go to that very specific example, is that we have the equilibrium as long as this gamma, the rate of some reaction keeping the equilibrium, is much, much bigger than h. So if this is no longer true, so if gamma is actually smaller than h, then no longer we have equilibrium. Equilibrium, and that's why we cannot use any of these formulas which were derived here. So this is very, very interesting for massive particles. So you know that as long as the massive particles are actually in equilibrium, they are exponentially suppressed. Okay, so it means that actually we wouldn't observe any massive particles if they were in equilibrium. Okay, so actually what has to happen is that at some point you have only so little number of these massive particles so that actually they cannot maintain the reaction which is keeping them in equilibrium with the rest. And so they sort of decouple from the rest. But once they decouple, they are not in equilibrium, they are not exponentially suppressed. In fact, their number is conserved since after that. Okay, so and this leads to the decoupling, and the decoupling happens at freeze out. People say that number freeze out or whatever. So let me give you this very, very specific example of what could have happened to one more blackboard, to the cold dark matter. So let's consider the following example. You will see more examples later on, but consider cold dark matter, and let's assume that it corresponds to some particle chi. So now, of course, if the temperatures are much, much bigger than the mass of this particle, then the particle is relativistic and it's in equilibrium. So now what happens is that if you have temperature smaller than m chi, then this becomes, so chi no longer relativistic. So, you know, at the Big Bang, when the universe was very hot, we had relativistic dark matter, particle chi. It was, you know, interacting with all the other relativistic species. It was in the thermal bath, as we describe over here. So now, as the universe is cooling down, the temperature suddenly, well, finally actually reaches that it's smaller than m chi, and chi is no longer relativistic. And so because it's no longer relativistic but still interacting with other species, it's still in a thermal equilibrium with other species, it's exponentially suppressed. Because that's what we've shown here. So exponentially suppressed. So now let me make one more assumption. For example, let's assume that we have the following reaction. So let's say that to destroy chi, I have the simplest possible reaction I can think about is that the chi meets anti-chi, produces some photons, and that's it. And of course, as long as we have equilibrium, this reaction is going both ways. And so I can be popping out chi's and chi's bars from the vacuum or whatever. But once this is no longer true, the reaction actually goes one way. So I'm really trying to destroy as much chi as I want. I want to exponentially suppress chi here. So I'm producing the photons, but not the other way around. So now, when gamma is actually small, the reaction rate of this thing here is smaller than h. Very physically, chi cannot find its antipartner, chi bar, to annihilate this. There's so little of these guys. He played with. And so this reaction basically stops working. So the chi has to travel through the whole universe to find its antipartner, and it never finds it. So it can never actually annihilate to produce gamma. So what it means is that actually the number of chi's is now conserved. Okay, so from here, it means that if this is true, the number of chi's after this will be approximately constant. Or if you want, the number density of chi is proportional to 1 over a cube. It's just diluting as the volume would. But if you measure that in the temperature of the CMB, then you know that T goes like 1 over A for CMB. So actually, you know that the number of chi particles, the density, goes like the CMB temperature here. CMB. This is called freeze out. So let me draw this beautiful picture. What's happening? This chi. So on one axis, I'll put the number of chi, number density of chi divided by t cube. And on the other axis, I'll put the mass of chi divided by temperature. So now, if m chi over t, chi, am I doing the right thing? So if m is smaller than t, yeah, so that's fine. So if m is smaller than t, I'm relativistic. I'm relativistic here. And then here, I'm non-relativistic. So as long as it is relativistic, we derive that n, the density of the particles, behaves like t cube. So this is actually constant. So now I'm becoming non-relativistic. And if I'm non-relativistic, I should be exponentially suppressed. Okay, so this is what should be happening. I should be really exponentially decaying down. But at some point, actually, this reaction no longer works because I cannot find the antipartner. And so after that, actually, the particle number is conserved. And n chi goes like t cube again, of the CMB. So this is what actually happened. So if we maintained the thermal equilibrium, there wouldn't be any chi particles left later on. But because we don't, we actually stop that reaction. It's not important anymore. We actually can still find some particles. So this is relic density. We still can observe some dark matter things. This would be the line of equilibrium. Goes like e to minus m chi over t. So this would be that exponential suppression of that. And then when actually the true thing departures from what you predict from equilibrium thing, this is the freeze out. So, and that you find from saying gamma is actually h. Okay, so the true evolution will be something like this. So this is what is happening, and what could have happened actually is the dark matter maybe. And so now I justify the statement is the departure from equilibrium, which makes life interesting because if you didn't, there wouldn't be any chi particles left. They would be just die by this exponential suppression. But we are lucky there was a departure from equilibrium. And we can still see some dark matter particles, maybe. Are there any questions to this? Yes?
Does it mean that at the beginning of the universe, the number of chi and chi bar are not the same?
Well, of course. So by this thing here, I'm not saying that there are no some chi bars as well, right? Typically, what happens is that indeed, the number of matter and antimatter is not the same. It's a problem of biogenesis. So why actually there was more matter than antimatter to start with? I don't think there is a satisfactory answer for that. Although there's some general framework, for example, by Sakharov done. But yeah, here I would have relic density of chi bar as well, in principle. Just you know, for considering this thing here.
Can you remind me why 1 over a cubed has to go like t, like CMB?
So, okay. So this one here. This thing here? Oh, this is what we've shown when we discussed how the light propagates in expanding FRW spacetime. So remember that we showed, what did we show? We showed that the omega, the frequency of these things, goes like 1 over a. But again, you can show that So energy goes like 1 over A, and here the temperature is the energy, proportional to the energy, so that's why. Okay, so now we will also need one more thing to discuss the thermal history, and that's a little bit about chemical potentials. So far we have been so sort of neglecting them, but sometimes they are actually important and interesting. And there is a very detailed exposure to chemical potentials in expanding universe in Mukanov's book. So if you are interested, he devotes the whole chapter to that. I'll just mention three very, very basic properties. So three remarks on chemical potentials. So the first one, so we know that in QFT, particles can pop out of vacuum. So in general, actually, the number of particles is not conserved. And the statement is, unless there is a conservation law, this is a very inaccurate statement, but it doesn't matter. Unless, all I want to say is that mu for photons is zero. But anyway, unless there is a conservation law protecting particle number, then we have mu equals to zero. So this is certainly true for photons, which is basically what I want to say. So photons actually have the chemical potential equal to zero. And you can think about it like it really doesn't cost any energy to create photons in some sense. So if you think about the first law, now with the chemical potential term as well. So unless, so you know that, you know, number of photons can fluctuate, and I can, you know, create lots of photons. And so unless this guy is zero, then it costs energy. So anyway, so the moral of the story is that photons always have a mu equal to zero. Okay. So now what we also need is that if you have some chemical reaction, and this is in equilibrium process. So let's say I have particle A interacting with particle B, and this gives me C and D, and the process is going both ways. It's not going only one way. Then actually the chemical potentials are, as you would expect, so mu A plus mu B equals to mu C plus mu D. So now if you apply this, for example, annihilation of electron and positron. So if I have example that electron plus positron giving 2 gamma, then we already established that mu of gamma is zero. So you immediately conclude that mu of electron is actually minus mu of positron. So they have equal but opposite chemical potentials. And then finally, what is actually interesting is that if you have some conservation laws, so conservation laws, you can actually infer from them on how this chemical potential looks like. And typically, the chemical potential depends on the temperature. So can find how mu behaves as a function of temperature. And this is very important because as the universe is cooling down, the chemical potential is changing. And so to actually model things very, like more exactly, you have to take this temperature dependence of mu into consideration. So let me just mention one example. It'll be conservation. And now you will hate me as of Lepton's number of lepton number. And let me do it for electrons. So you have something Le, and this will be given by number of electrons minus number of positrons plus the number of the corresponding neutrinos. So mu e minus the antineutrino. And then you can show that this quantity here, but this is the density of entropy is equal to constant. So this is one conservation law which you get. OK, very good. So now in your homework again, you will maybe prove the relation that this is true. So the number of electrons minus the number of anti-electrons is actually depends on temperature like this, T cube, the chemical potential of electron divided by temperature again. So by the way, this is an optional problem in your homework. It's a little bit tricky. So if you don't know how to solve it, just look it up. And it's discussed in Donaldson. So if you actually borrow that book, you will have the solution for that problem. Or because it's optional, you just don't have to care. But I'm just giving you the result. So this is what is true. So now if you plug it in, you know that, S goes like T cube. And then I have this thing. And this will be true also. Here, so somehow from here you could conclude that mu electron plus mu of neutrino divided by T is a constant. So that's what follows from this conservation law. So it actually tells you how this chemical potential of electron and neutrino depends on the temperature. And of course, you can have many other conservation laws, which give you other relations, how the chemical potential actually looks like in the expanding universe. So anyway, these are just examples. And as I said, all we basically need is this thing here and this thing here. And that one we don't really need. But if you are interested, just read Mukanov's book. Maybe it's not the place. Are there any questions to this? So I have 5 minutes. So now let me just do the brief history of universe. And not that it's really brief, but I'll do it very briefly. And that gives you an overview of what we are going to discuss next week, and you will discuss in your tutorials and stuff like that. So part B is brief thermal history. By the way, now it should be obvious that I can always, if I talk about the history of the universe, I can talk about how big the scale factor is, but I can also equally translate this to the temperature of the CMB, or I can translate that to when actually this happened in the coordinate time t, or what was the corresponding redshift for the things and stuff like that. So you can always switch from you know, all these quantities. Yeah, you can go like that. And there is also a magic formula for if you are in radiation era, then how to translate precisely this time t to the temperature. So how actually this translates, and this is like a phenomenological formula, but it works very well in the radiation era, and that's that if you measure the temperature or the energy in MeVs, then it's basically 1 divided by square root of t measured in seconds. Okay, so if you want to know what was the energies of the universe in 1 second after Big Bang, then you know it was MeV. Okay, that how hot the universe was. Okay, very good. So now if I draw the line t, so this is where we are now. We are 10 to the 16 seconds after the Big Bang. So t is in seconds. And so we now observe the galaxies. And other things. So these galaxies were formed by gravitational collapse, by gravitational instabilities. And so the structure formation, the galaxy formation and stuff like that is a very, very interesting topic. Unfortunately, we will not have time to discuss it. But I think partly maybe discuss in exploration course. So I will not say anything about this. But still, actually, an ongoing research. And people still invent more and more complicated numerical codes where you actually you can do structure formation. Okay. So now, the thing which was very interesting is at 10 to 12, the CMB was released. And we will discuss that in detail. But what actually basically happened, not really, is that the electrons recombined with protons to form the hydrogen. This is not very accurate, but yeah. And so once you don't have plasma anymore, then actually the photons are sort of free to roam through the universe. And so before you had like this very hot soup of plasma and nobody could see anything. But now after this has actually happened, then because the photons can actually travel, you can start seeing things at some nice distances. Okay, so now 10 to the 11, radiation matter equality. So at this point, the radiation has the same energy density as the matter. This is a very important point for structure formation. So actually, you can show that the structures form differently in the radiation era and form differently in the matter-dominated era. And so that's why this is important. So now let me make a huge jump here, and let me go back to 3 minutes. Okay. Which is by using that magic formula, 0.1 MeV. So anything which is below this is already radiation. So at 3 minutes, Big Bang nucleosynthesis, so basically you fused heavy elements out of hydrogen, so you form helium, and you form lithium, and other things, and we will discuss that on Monday. This is very interesting physics. So before that, the electrons annihilated the positrons, creating lots of gamma. So at about 6 seconds, electron minus, electron plus annihilation. This thing is rather interesting because what happened is that actually the neutrinos decoupled before. So neutrinos decoupling is sometime here. So after the neutrino decoupling, the neutrinos actually roam free through the universe and they are not bothered anymore with anything else. But of course, the reaction here involves gammas, so involves photons. So photons actually got some energy out of this. And so that's why actually CMB was heated up by the process of electron and positron annihilation. And that's why the temperature of CMB, temperature of photons, is actually bigger than the temperature of neutrinos. It's a very, very clear prediction of hot Big Bang theory. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to measure the temperature of neutrinos. Okay, because it's very difficult to capture them, right? So actually, there's very, very clear prediction, which you will derive in a tutorial next week, you know, how these temperatures are related, but it hasn't been verified yet.
So this is the freeze-out because we need some electrons to produce something else at the end, right?
You need...
It's a freeze-out of electrons, so at the end, we still have some electrons?
Yeah, in the end, very, very good question. So, of course, not everything annihilated completely. We still have some leftover electrons, and thanks. Of course. So now at about 1 second, which is 1 MeV, by magic formula, you have this neutrino decoupling. And so this is also a very interesting thing because neutrinos are something, if you have neutrinos participating things, that precisely neutrons can change to protons plus neutrinos. So there's a reaction changing neutrons to protons so if once the neutrinos actually decoupled, you have independent neutrons and independent protons. So neutron, proton ratio freezes out. But of course, this could be a disaster because you know that whereas the proton is actually a stable thing and it can live forever, neutrons are very, very unstable. They live, I don't know, 10 minutes or something like that. Okay. So actually, at 1 second, the neutrons are separate from protons. Protons live happily ever after. But neutrons start decaying like crazy. Right? So you have only very, very few, you know, minutes to capture these neutrons in the heavier elements. Because if you don't capture them in a few minutes, then they will simply decay and you will never see any neutrons again. Okay? So that's why the Big Bang nuclear synthesis actually had to happen very soon, because then you couldn't have any neutrons after that. Okay? So then nobody knows what happens to the dark matter when it actually throws out and decouples from the rest of the thing. But what we know is that at 10 to minus 5 seconds, 150 MeV, we have QCD, phase transition. So quarks are now confined. At 10 to minus 10 seconds, which is 100 GeV, then we have electroweak phase transition. So we actually, you know, the Higgs mechanism and stuff like that. And then up to the 10 to minus 14 seconds, we still understand. So this is 10 electron volts. So we know that up to here, actually, we understand physics quite well because we have Large Hadron Collider. So these are all still the energies the Large Hadron Collider can go to. So up to here, it should be well understood physics. Meaning supported by the experiment. Okay. So what you can place before that is highly speculative, although not so much from the theory point of view. So then you can have things like topological defects formed. So you can have cosmic strings, and you can have domain walls and stuff like that. So then what happens here is speculative, but you could, one of them is this baryogenesis. And there is this miraculous number eta, which is number of baryons divided by number of photons. And it's 10 to minus 9. So you had to have 10 to minus 9. Very, very important number. You'll see it many more times in the course. So how many baryons divided by how many photons are there? And so what it means actually that for 10 to the 9 antiprotons, you had to have 10 to the 9 plus 1 protons. And they annihilated and they created gamma. And so this is what had to happen. And so people try to explain this. You could have these topological defects, which Ruth discussed in her course, defects formation, like cosmic strings and whatever. They could have been formed. Nobody observed them so far, and they would significantly mess with CMB and stuff like that. So there's upper limits on how many objects you can have of these types. And then another speculation is, of course, inflation here. And then you have Planck length somewhere. And then you have the Big Bang here. And that's the other speculation, what's happening there. OK, so questions? Now we will discuss, you know, some examples of these things in more detail next week.
Yes. QCDPT basically is the formation of protons and neutrons. And what happened between 10 to the 11 minus 3 minutes?
10 to the 11 to 3 minutes, nothing really interesting. Yeah, well. Well, you have the plasma there, and yeah, the structure started forming, but yeah, you have some deep fluctuations in the plasma. And, yeah. You cannot see anything. Other questions? Excellent. So have a nice weekend.